had a big announcement about homelessness in the three counties, and you're looking at 2017. I take it that's the most recent year for which data is available, right?
Consistent data. So, well, we do know that Multnomah County has their 2019 point in time count data out. We have Department of Education records for the schools that came out last year in 2018, but the only data that we had across the board was from 2017.
Okay. So you have a pretty cohesive view of what went on in 2017, and the numbers seem pretty high.
Right. And I think that that comes from the fact that most people focus on the point in time count. The point in time count is a one night count on a very narrowly construed definition of homelessness. In our report, we first take a look at homelessness across the year. So we're looking at annualized reports, and we include what is described as the doubled up population. That's the population that the schools report on every year, and that is not included with the point in time count HUD definition. So if you actually look at annualized numbers and the school numbers, this number really shouldn't be surprising. It's just that, again, a lot of people focus on that one night point in time count.
When you count somebody as homeless, are you counting, like, say, somebody who's couch surfing or somebody who's a runaway? Or, I mean, how does it qualify as an instance of specifically a homelessness? Do they have to be on the street for that to count, or how does that work?
So federal agencies have different definitions. HUD is the most restricted. They would not count someone who was couch surfing. They would count a runaway who was sleeping in a car or sleeping on the street, someone who's in emergency shelter or transitional housing. Department of Education does extend the definition to people who are living on couches or attics or sheds, or maybe even camping with a tent in the backyard, and they're sharing their housing, or they're sharing the housing of someone else because they don't have an economic option.
Mm-hmm. So whose numbers are you using then? The more restricted definition, or you're using everything? So this is a really inclusive definition that includes basically everybody.
Yes. Yeah, so one of the reasons why I wanted to do the report was that we feel like when you really focus on that narrow definition, we are not really accounting for the range and number of people who are experiencing homelessness and the costs that we're really going to be looking at long term.
You know, the costs just are astronomical, right?
I mean, I think that it depends on your framing. So first of all, when people say the numbers are high, I like to say that 38,000 people experiencing homelessness in 2017 was about 2% of the population. So that's actually not a lot of people who were houseless in relationship to the entire population. When we look at the number of households that were housing insecure, it's 107,000 in 2017. That's only about 16% of all of the households in the area. If we wanted to, say, provide rent assistance dollars for the 83,000 households that are most housing insecure, meaning that they pay more than 50% of their rent or their housing costs from their income on housing costs, we would be looking instead at a number that is closer to $10,000 to $20,000 a year per household. So when we start breaking down those numbers, they become a lot more manageable. The other thing is that I think a lot of times people don't think about housing as basic infrastructure. And as a city planner, I'm used to thinking about billions of dollars in the context of transportation systems, sewage, wastewater management, parks, green space. Those really expensive. Housing is part of our basic infrastructure, and it costs a lot.
Yeah, it certainly does. Now, you're talking about costs that could, I think the range was pretty wide, between 2.7 million to $4 billion. I mean, that's a huge range. What could affect whether it's on the lower end or the higher end there?
So both for the estimates for people experiencing homelessness as well as for homelessness prevention, we developed a range of scenarios. Part of our goal was to give people in the community the ability to look at the information and decide which portion of the population do we want to focus on? Who do we want to try to serve first? Do we want to try to help everyone at once? And so in order to do that, we looked at ranges of rents, ranges of income groups. For the people experiencing homelessness, the $2.6 billion to $4.1 billion really gets at how much housing the government is building versus how much people are being able to find housing through private leases. And so the low end is where the government builds less housing. The high end is where the government builds more housing.
Okay. So let's talk about, you know, basically how does this compare to other years? What we know about 2017, how does that compare? Are we getting a grip on the problem? Is it getting worse? We're not getting a grip on it. What's going on?
So we didn't really do any comparative studies. We wanted to just start with a snapshot and see where that took us. Based on the economy, when we started to have our housing market prices go up here, we're going to start seeing an increase in people who are housing insecure and experiencing homelessness. We know that goes together. The number of people who have been experiencing homelessness has been with us for some time, so I wouldn't expect there to be great variation if we looked back to, say, 2015, just as the market was getting going.
Around the year that the crunch time really started was 2015,
mm-hmm.
and that's when, and it's been kind of steady since then?
Right. And people will point to the fact that there is at least some perception of relief in the market. However, that's really at the high end, so the luxury end of the market. And when we really think about submarkets, which are really important for housing, we're not seeing that kind of change within people within the housing market that's for the lower income populations.
Yeah, and all the discussions about the rent, price fixing of the rent, and also adding ADUs and making that more accessible, has that had any impact that you can see yet? Well, probably not, because you're talking about 2017, right?
Right. None of that would all of that is so recent. It's going to take some time to see what that actually does and how much it actually does.
Uh-huh. Tell me, like, the average person who's in this insecure population, what's their life like?
They are making really tough choices between paying the rent and paying for medicine. Where we really start to see a lot of challenges is people foregoing prescription drugs that they need, diabetes care, insulin, in order to be able to make that rent payment happen. We're also seeing people who are in these situations having to move frequently. So they might be housing insecure in one place and they have to move to another and another. So we start to see a lot of disruptions in work, and in particular in school. And so we suddenly have kids who are moving schools multiple times a year. So they're having to make some really tough choices around food insecurity, paying bills, paying the electric, in order to just be able to pay the rent to keep a place.
Wow. And as far as the person who is actually among the homeless people, the 38,000, what is their life like?
We have a wide variety there, right? We definitely know that we see people on the street who are suffering from severe mental illness, people who might have drug addiction, and they have no place to go. And they have no housing to access. They're probably being served by some type of support services. But until we're able to actually provide adequate housing, it makes it really difficult for them to be able to start managing any of their diseases. We have people who are fleeing domestic violence, who are in emergency shelter, women with children. I've definitely run into people sleeping in their cars or their RVs on my street. That's not uncommon anymore. And then, of course, we have the people who are doubled up, who are just trying to make something work with a friend or with a neighbor or with a cousin. And sometimes those relationships can be abusive.
Oh, yeah, that's heartbreaking. Are you seeing people coming who are homeless from other areas moving here because we have access to services? I don't know if that's a myth or if that's truth. That I've heard about that for a long time, that Portland welcomes the homeless people, so they come here because we have great services for them.
We just did a myth-busting campaign. And one of the top 10 myths is people coming here for services. This is actually a myth that is in every city across the country and in Canada. So whenever you go to Seattle, Vancouver, BC, San Francisco, Washington, D.C., everyone will say, people who are homeless are coming to us because we have X. Portland is a little bit different because until recently, we haven't really tried to clear people from the streets in the ways that other locations have. And so it's not that there are fewer people, it's just that we haven't necessarily aggressively banished them to the furthest areas of the region. But yes, I think in the 2017 point in time count, only 10% of people who were asked reported that they actually moved here to receive services, and they may have moved here from Clackamas or Washington County. So top myth, love it, totally wrong.
So I would say, you say like over 90% are neighbors mm-hmm. who have fallen on hard times.
Yes.
Is what it sounds like.
Yes, absolutely. Neighbors who have fallen on hard times, neighbors who have been exploited, neighbors who have been abused, a whole gamut of things. You know, you'll hear the saying a lot that most of us are one paycheck away from homelessness. And that's not an uncommon metric or reality. How much money does everybody have saved up in their bank account? Do you really have the social support networks of people who could take you in and that not be an unsafe situation?
Okay, I'm curious about the other myths on your list. What are some other common myths and misconceptions that are out there about homelessness?
You're putting me on the spot. Let me see if I can remember them. One of the big ones is that people of color are less likely to be homeless. That is a myth. People of color face significantly higher rates of homelessness when compared to their white counterparts. In the 2017 point in time, Native Americans were 400% more likely to be homeless, and African Americans were 180% more likely to be homeless in Multnomah County. The idea that students are not homeless, right? And a lot of us will think about, oh, you know, we all crammed into that house together and it was so much fun. That's not today's student. When they're cramming into a house together, it is often a house that they should not be living in. It may be that instead of having five people crammed in, they have 10. We have students who live on our campus. We have students who live in their cars on this campus. And so really understanding that the college homelessness is not what we thought it was before.
What else? What else are we wrong about? In our public perception, set us right here.
So I think that the big thing, and this is what the report is emphasizing, is that the people that we see on the street are only a small fraction of the people who are homeless. And they are certainly a tiny fraction of the people who are experiencing housing insecurity. And so when we look at everyone on the street, part of the reason why we're saying this isn't working and there's more people is because we aren't really thinking about the fact that we're looking at 38,000 people instead of 6,000 or even 4,000 if you look at unsheltered only. And the people who are on the street aren't necessarily representative of everyone who's experiencing homelessness. There are people who need a lot of help to move into housing. And there are other people who just need some rent assistance to get by. And I think it's hard for people to keep that front and center. Mm-hmm. The other myth is that the city and the counties aren't doing anything. And I understand how that feels that way. I was talking with Mark Jolin from the Joint Office of Homeless Services, and he was talking about how one night during 2019, they actually provided services for 12,000 people. There have been numbers and years where they have served up to 35,000 people. Now, we don't know if those supports are adequate, but they're helping people get by. They're helping prevent homelessness. They're helping resolve homelessness for people. And so people are getting services. The city and the county are trying. But when we're really driven by a point in time count, and we're not really thinking about the fact that the cause of homelessness is not having housing, we actually aren't resourcing this properly.
Were there any surprises that came up in this research or anything that was like, wow, that's really striking?
I'm not sure it was a surprise for me, but any of us who work on homelessness know that the data are really fraught. And so, you know, point in time count has a lot of issues. It's one night. It's a snapshot. Department of Ed depends on teachers identifying students who might be houseless. And so it's really just recognizing that as a researcher, I want to have a lot of precision. And this is asking the opposite of me. It's asking me to lean in to really messy data and, you know, estimates that could be plus or minus quite a bit. But when we started thinking about the fact that we were looking at estimates that would be over 10 years, we realized we didn't actually need to worry because we could be off by a significant number and not actually change the overall outcome.
Is there a take-home message that you would like people to know about what you found based on your research from 2017?
I'd really love for people to know that we actually can do this work locally. We don't need the federal government to bail us out. It would be nice, but 38,000 people or 107,000 households is not an insurmountable number. And it really just takes all of us who are in the position to be able to give a little bit more, to be a little bit more committed to policy discussions to make this happen.
Yeah, I know you were talking about the Joint Office of Homeless Services. Voters recently approved the bond between the counties for the area to have more money for homelessness. So I know the voters in this area seem to be supporting that. Do you think that those initiatives have a great chance of helping a lot of folks out there?
They will definitely help help a lot of people, they're not going to end our issues. There's just not enough. And I think it's wonderful that the voters have done this. I think it was a great first step. What we are trying to do with this report is to say, all right, this is triage. And what we're doing now is we're saving the children who are drowning, but we're not thinking about who's throwing the children in the river and then letting them drown. And so until we really think about this upstream, the upstream issues that are creating homelessness, we're going to be focusing on triage.
And what are those upstream issues?
The biggest one is obviously housing, right? So what are we going to do about our housing market? We can put out a lot of rent assistance dollars, but we have to decide if that's what we want to do forever, or do we actually want to really rethink our housing system and our housing markets? Do we really want to rethink about like universal basic income, right? If people don't have money, they can't afford housing. So what are the things that we think would work best and the things that we have the most influence on locally?
You know, I was going to ask you just in general, could you tell me about
the center?
The center itself, yeah.
So about a year ago, we were named a university research center. There was a competition to locate research centers of excellence on campus. We were one of the two centers selected out of 28 applications. So we're almost on our one-year anniversary. We came together, we're university-wide, which means we're interdisciplinary, and we came together across the fields of business, psychology, social work, public health, architecture, and engineering. And the idea is that we've received a one-time investment from the university to really support great research and great work to lift up this topic area.
That's great. And how long have you been researching homelessness?
5 years.
You're in the Portland?
Yes. New to me in Portland.
Why is this important to you?
You know, it's funny because what I study, I'm a long-range planner. I've studied plan-making processes, so how do you bring different stakeholders together to make plans and policies for different issues? Because of the nature of my work, it means that I can go into a lot of spaces. And so I received a phone call from the head of the Portland Housing Bureau at the time who said, hey, we've got this thing going on. It's about homelessness, but we're actually putting together a multi-stakeholder process. We really want to get into racial equity. I studied equitable processes, and I study equitable outcomes from those processes. So she's like, bring your knowledge to that. I knew very little about homelessness at that point in time. So the reason that I care is because someone asked me to.
That's awesome.
And I think that's what we're doing now is we're asking everyone to say, let's really care about housing insecurity and homelessness.
And this announcement you made, you chose to do it with the goal of spotlighting the problem or a call to action, or what was the idea there?
So we take our mission as being part of a public education system very seriously. And so what we really wanted to do was to give some scaffolding for community members, elected officials, advocates, people who have lived experiences homeless, to really come together and say, well, what are we really looking at? And then to help people start strategizing for what should our next steps really be? Again, we've had these great bonds go forward. We know we need more revenue. What revenue should we be going after? If we're going to have a triage situation, how long should that go on for? How do we start to move to the next level? And so we wanted to put some information and facts out there to say, here's a starting point for these conversations. So really hoping that we can empower people to start to take information and knowledge and to put it into action in the groups that they work.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Good.